Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Human Rights Watch accuses Rwanda of cruelty towards the poor and gay people.
What we've seen is that some members of the LGBT community have been ostracized socially, and when they have been rounded up and taken to Kwakabuga, they've told us that they're very much told that they are being detained because what they're doing is against Rwandan values.
Amnesty International is concerned about Gambia's oppressive laws that stifle freedom of expression. Botswana's alcohol industry is cautious as nightspots prepare to reopen. Experts say South Africa has exited its third coronavirus wave, and South Africa prepares for crucial November 1st local government elections.
The wealth of the country must be shared, and the rich must share with the poor through the property wealth tax that the EFF municipality is going to implement.
And the Benin National turns an invasive weed into a tool to fight pollution. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Human Rights Watch says the Rwanda government rounded up and arbitrarily detained over a dozen gay and transgender people, sex workers, and street children prior to the June 2021 Commonwealth meeting that was to be held in Kigali. Louise Mulch, Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch, said these people were held in the Kwakabuga neighborhood of the capital, known for its harsh and inhuman conditions. Rwanda's government spokesperson, Yolande Makolo, declined to be interviewed but sent a text message saying the report is a calculated attempt to harm a strategic sector of Rwanda's economy with fabricated allegations. She says Rwanda does not discriminate in law, policy, or practice against sexual or gender orientation. Mulch says Rwanda's Commonwealth partners have a choice, either to speak up for the rights of the victims or be silent as the crackdown is carried out in their name.
This detention center, Kwakabuga, it is not a secret at all. It is very much known about. And this is a place where people who are deemed undesirable in Kigali are swept up and are taken. And in particular, these people are taken in advance of international conferences like the Commonwealth Heads of Summit meeting, which we are going to be seeing rescheduled again for 2022. And this research from April to June revolves around the fact that we got to speak with people who had been detained in Gikondo, who told us that they were detained because of the Commonwealth meeting, which was originally scheduled for 2021, which had to get pushed back. So we're basically issuing this report as a sort of warning to let people know the abuses that are going to be happening in conjunction with this large international conference as it unfolds in Kigali in 2022.
You say people who are deemed undesirable. Are you saying that people, according to your report, that people, say gay people, are considered undesirable in Rwanda?
So this report focuses on people who are vulnerable and the most marginalized. This includes street children, sex workers, petty vendors, and in some instances, these are people from the LGBT community. It's important to note that Rwanda does have a moderate stance towards the LGBT community, and legally, that's a very good thing. But what we've seen is that some members of the LGBT community have been ostracized socially and as such have been out on the street. And when they have been rounded up and taken to Kwakabuga, they've told us that they're very much told that they are being detained because what they're doing is against Rwandan values.
I spoke to a spokesperson for the Rwandan government. She declined my request for an interview, but she sent me a statement, a text message saying that your report is a calculated attempt to harm a strategic sector of Rwanda's economy with fabricated allegations. She continues, the sabotage won't work as the allegations are not true. Rwanda does not discriminate in law, policy, or practice against sexual or gender orientation. Your comment.
She is absolutely conflating issues here. We have not said the government of Rwanda is discriminating on gender. We have said people who are vulnerable and marginalized in Rwandan society, including in some instances LGBT people, are being rounded up and held in Kwakabuga. And if this is Yolanda, for her to have the courage to deny that Kwakabuga exists is really going a step too far. This detention center is absolutely known about. You can ask anybody in Kigali, and they will tell you if they are poor, they fear being rounded up and held in Kwakabuga. If the government of Rwanda wanted Human Rights Watch to do their reporting on Rwanda in the most effective way possible, they would allow us back into the country. But the fact is that they want these things to happen hidden, and so they continue to keep us on the outside. And this is not an attack on any degree of Rwanda's economic sectors. This is an attempt to shut down Gikondo Transit Center, to shut down Kwakabuga, and to end the abuses that are happening there, Rwanda.
What action, for example, do you think the Rwandan government or even the same Commonwealth you mentioned in your report, what can be done because of your report?
On the Rwandan government side, we think they should close Kwakabuga. They should close the Gikondo Transit Center, and they should take steps to provide these people who are economically vulnerable with socioeconomic programs whereby they can enrich their lives. Don't punish them for being poor. To the members of the Commonwealth who are going to be participating in this meeting, we say, you know, please ask tough questions about the Gikondo Transit Center and other abuses that are happening in Rwanda. Human rights, in theory, are a pillar of the Commonwealth's sort of bedrock mandate. And, you know, for them to hold this conference in Kigali while simultaneously poor people are being rounded up and hidden from the actual conference participants could go to a line towards perhaps complicity in human rights abuses.
Louise March is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. You are speaking with us from the United States. As the November 1st date for local government elections in South Africa fast approaches, political parties are out in full force with promises, including many that have been constantly broken. Major and smaller parties are launching manifestos promising relief, like improved social services for rising unemployment and poverty. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
It's election season and political parties are back to the people with a list of familiar promises. They guarantee houses and good sanitation to the homeless. Villages without clean, reliable water are also being told to expect taps in their kitchens. All parties have included strong language of fighting what citizens say is the country's worst enemy to progress, corruption. The ruling African National Congress has been branded a symbol of corruption by many, but party president Cyril Ramaphosa has instructed those contesting on behalf of his party to clean up its soiled image.
Stand up against corruption and mismanagement and continuously improve the functioning of local government, and that you should be the best councillors our nation has ever seen.
The country's largest opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, has also deployed campaigners in townships and villages, promising to deliver basic services to all municipalities that give it a majority. Party leader John Steyn Hansen delivered the party's manifesto.
We also believe in employing only fit-for-purpose individuals to government and then demanding accountability from them, because this is the only way to build a capable state. We have zero tolerance for corruption.
The Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF party, that has pushed for the expropriation of land without compensation, nationalization of mines, and establishment of a state bank, has plenty of promises for the poor. This is what its leader Julius Malema had to say during the launch of his party's manifesto.
The wealth of the country must be shared, and the rich must share with the poor, and they shall do so through the property wealth tax that the EFF municipality is going to implement.
But political analyst Levin Doe says not all promises will be fulfilled.
Each party would come with their own programs, promises, and make all the promises, but the implementation time has to happen after the elections.
With some of the promises having stayed on the party's list for over two decades, It is now up to the electorate to separate reality from fiction. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Africa has exited its third coronavirus wave. Thus, according to the country's National Institute for Communicable Diseases, it says just over 87,000 COVID-related deaths have been tallied since it started keeping records in March last year. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to the Institute's head of public health surveillance and response, Dr. Michelle Groom.
Groom says at the peak of its third wave, they were recording 20,000 positive cases a day. She says for a second day in a row today, the cases are below 1,000, with the number of active cases now over 50,000.
So definitely the case numbers have come down, as well as the number of positive tests out of the total number of tests that are done. And so at the peak of the wave, that was over 30%, and it's come down quite quickly in the last 2 weeks, and is now under 5% positivity.
Groom thinks that in the future, identifying the whole country as being in a wave will be used less, and people will talk more about resurgences in particular regions. She says that vaccines won't entirely eliminate the coronavirus, but will reduce severe cases and deaths. That means there will have to be a new way of coping with COVID-19.
And so I think we really need to start integrating COVID more into our routine health services and even to integrate vaccination. And I think what some of the provinces, for example, have been, you know, when patients come for their chronic medications, also offering vaccination. And so this is definitely a disease we're going to be living with for the foreseeable future. And so I think we really need to, you know, try and shift our thinking from being either in a wave or before a wave or after a wave or preparing for the next wave, and really try and see how long term we're going to be living with the virus.
Having said that, with the summer school and workers' Christmas holidays just months away, there is concern about a fourth wave.
I think, look, it's a definite risk with us only having vaccinated a fifth of our adult population at the moment. I think the election, the run-up to the local government elections in November is also a bit of a concern, just in terms of political rallies or get-togethers that may occur. So we do need to keep a watch on that. So I think for the foreseeable future as well, until our vaccination rates are much higher, you know, I think we definitely need to still adhere to the mask-wearing, hand hygiene, and social distancing, and to be aware of these social gatherings as being potential super spreader events.
Groom explained why the South African government is so unhappy about the United Kingdom's refusal to take it off its travellers' red list.
I think from the reports that I've seen, that they've mentioned that Beta was still very prevalent in South Africa, which is not the case, as the Beta variant has decreased, and Delta variant is, you know, accounts for, I think it was more than 96% of the cases in South Africa. And so to use the Beta variant as the reason is scientifically flawed. And I think it's hard to understand why individuals from South Africa who are vaccinated with the same vaccines that are in use in the UK would not fulfill their criteria for not having to quarantine.
The South African newspaper, The Sunday Times, reported that a delegation from the Department of Health and several scientists would be meeting virtually with the UK government on this issue. Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 28. Botswana is set to emerge this week from an 18-month state of emergency that will remove the president's emergency powers and end pandemic restrictions on trade and gatherings. While many shops, bars, and restaurants want to get back to normal, some in Botswana's alcohol industry say it's too soon to lift restrictions on night spots. Mkundisi Dube reports.
The Minister of Trade and Industry, Kafela Musi, says the end of the edict set for this Thursday means businesses can revert to normal trading hours. This includes the reopening of night spots. That should be welcome news to Botswana's alcohol industry, which employs around 50,000 people, including those who work at bars, breweries and distributors. But Botswana Beverages Association President Peter Noke warns some establishments might not be ready to reopen. Those that do will likely have restrictions, including a ban on dancing.
kopile gore mo bogompieno the dance floors at the club ona me go replace.
He said they have requested that dance floors be converted into sitting areas. There should be sufficient spacing between the tables and there will be no dancing. He said if one wishes to dance, Noke said they can only do so while seated. Music promoter Zain Aftermath says the decision to eliminate the dance floor is ill-advised.
How are you going to open clubs and then you say people should not dance? It doesn't make sense. I wouldn't leave my house to go to a nightclub and pay and buy alcohol so that I can sit on a chair. It's going to affect attendance at the club in a huge way.
Workers union leader Johannes Tsubutu welcomes the reopening as entertainment industry workers have been mostly out of work since March of last year, but he too urges caution.
We don't expect full capacity at the beginning. We may decide to have either half capacity of the venue so that at least we use that as an observation element, because we don't want to see this thing as a trap by government to justify reintroduction of the state of emergency.
Minister Khafela says the government will keep an eye on night spots to ensure compliance with the rules. Mkwandisi Dube for VOA News, Habaroni.
As Gambia's December presidential election nears, oppressive freedom of expression laws remain, according to a new report out by Amnesty International. Amnesty West Africa researcher Michelle Ikan spoke to Ricky Stryak about concerns surrounding the continued use of oppressive laws to stifle freedom of expression.
Although they are not as used as they were under Yahya Jammeh, some of them have been used in the last couple of years. So looking, for example, at the criminal code, there are several provisions which restrict freedom of expression. There's also Section 5 of the Public Order Act, which restricts freedom of assembly because it gives too much leeway to the head of the police to decide when protests can happen. And also looking at the constitution, the current constitution, there's still a lot of immunity clauses which allow for impunity.
How important is this in regards to some of Barrow's recent statements? Especially, I think about a month ago, he made a statement about cracking down potentially on social media. Many in Gambia took it as kind of a quote threat or a vow to crack down on freedom of speech in the country, given the elections are in December.
It's very, very important to have strong legal foundation. We cannot just rely on the government goodwill to make sure that human rights are respected. Civil society needs to have strong legal foundation to fall back on if their rights are violated. So it's very important to make sure that those important reforms are done, especially ahead of the elections.
In regards to the elections, this is the first election that will take place after Jammeh's departure. Obviously, going into it, do you feel like there is more freedom of speech, given that Jammeh is gone? But also, the current president's party recently aligned with Jammeh's party.
In terms of political alliance, we don't have specific opinion on that. What I would say is that no political consideration or process of reconciliation should hinder accountability. So what happens in the future, victims should have a recourse to seek justice, and alleged perpetrators of violent crime should be prosecuted. So it's important to make sure that this foundation is not, regardless of any political consideration, is taken into consideration.
In regards to the Truth, Reconciliation, and Reparations Commission, which is submitting their final report this week, have these laws hindered their investigation, or what is the impact of these laws on that commission?
Well, we don't know yet the contents of the recommendation from the TRC, but if, for example, they recommend for prosecution, there is an issue with a lot of immunity clauses that are still present, for example, in the Constitution. So it's important for those laws to be rectified, so the TRC recommendation could be fully followed.
That was Amnesty International West Africa researcher Michelle Ikan. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. The South American water hyacinth is an invasive weed that blocks waterways and kills native plants. In the West African country of Benin, entrepreneurs are finding creative ways to harvest the hyacinth to help clean up the environment. Moki Edwin Kinzika narrates this report by Anne Nzuanku in the Lake Village of Ganvi, Benin.
Ganvi is the largest lake city in West Africa, but the invasive water hyacinth has made life on the lake a struggle for navigation and fishing. To cope with the problem, local authorities are training women to harvest the hyacinth for compost and to make artwork.
Ça fait un plus value. C'est une activité générative de revenus.
Dominic Faison of the So Ava municipality says it is an added value, an income-generating activity for these groups. In the past, people used to say in the local language, "Toble or hyacinth is bad." Today, the hyacinth is called Tognon or the benefactor. Beninese mechanic Diodone Siwale has a messy job that leaves oil spills that can pollute the environment. But for the past 2 years, he has been using a fiber made from hyacinth that absorbs the oil waste so it can be swept up and safely disposed.
Le nettoyage est tellement propre et on a la facilité.
He says now the cleaning is so clean and it's easy to get the hydrocarbons off the floor. He adds, before he only used sand, and then the floor was not clean. Besides, the recycling of the sand was not easy nor recommended. Beninese startup Greenkeeper Africa makes the fiber to reduce both the hyacinth problem and oil pollution. Founder Fola Mufchau says 1 kilogram of hyacinth fiber can absorb up to 12 kilograms of oil.
La jacinthe est collectée, transformée, conditionnée, vendue au client.
He says the hyacinth is collected, processed, sold to the customer, and the company recovers it after use for incineration. Mufchau says he believes this is the first purely African solution that allows people to manage both an environmental and an industrial problem in a sustainable way. Local authorities are expanding the plant's use with a hyacinth-based ethanol gel that can be used for cooking fuel instead of burning wood. Beninese authorities hope the innovations will turn an invasive pest into a useful tool and protect their unique lake city. For Anne Zwanke in Ganvier, Benin, Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies. 60-80 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15-580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.